Mushroom Mania, why foraging and cultivating mushrooms is all the rage in Maine. Maybe you've seen them at farmers markets, fantastical mushrooms in all kinds of hues still growing on their base. Maybe you've taken a foraging class so that you can spot and harvest chanterelles in the woods near your home. Or maybe you've recently branched out to include more specialty mushrooms in your cooking, because you've heard that they can boost your health, or because they're showing up on more fine dining menus. There are all kinds of reasons that interest in mushrooms is on the rise. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll turn to some of Maine's mycological experts to learn more about these fantastic fungi, how to stay away from the poisonous ones, and how mushroom production is contributing to Maine's economy. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Mushrooms have such fun names, from hen of the woods to lion's mane to lobster mushrooms, and they can be many things to many people. To some, they are just annoying fungi popping up in the lawn. Others go out into Maine's forests to forage for them. They are treasured by chefs, can be used as medicine, and sometimes can be deadly. Today, we're going to learn about identifying different mushrooms and why growing mushrooms is taking off in Maine. In the studio with me, Greg Marley. He's with the Maine Mycological Association. Bet you just learned something. And he's the founder of Mushrooms for Health. He's also written two books about mycology. Matt McGinnis is one of the founders of North Spore, which cultivates edible mushrooms and promotes education and foraging for mushrooms. And Mark Robinson is co-owner of Cap and Stem Mushroom Company of Maine, an organic mushroom substrate producer. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever tried to forage for mushrooms? Do you have questions about different kinds of mushrooms and what they're good for? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Such a fun topic today. I'm going to start with you, Greg, because I understand you are called the Mushroom Man. Is that right?
Never by me.
But I want to, you know, I'm going to ask all three of you the same question to start, because I have a feeling there's an interesting story in each case. Greg, how did you get interested in mushrooms?
Well, I spent my first 25 years living in New Mexico, where I grew up. But when I was 15, I climbed on a bus in Albuquerque and got off in New York State and spent the summer in the Mid-Hudson River Valley. Never been east of El Paso. Totally fascinated by the greenery and the richness of the forest and the mushrooms. Amaze me.
New Mexico is not mushroom central.
Not great. High elevation, yes. So 2 years later, I bought my first book, and it's been on ever since.
So it went from curiosity and excitement to your life's work.
To obsession.
Okay, Mark, your turn. How did you get interested in mushrooms?
Well, actually, I first was very interested in all things green. Really, plants were one of my, you know, loves. You know, grew up in the forest quite a bit. Was not a latchkey kid. Definitely was out in the woods, poking around, you know, catching frogs and just learning.
Here in Maine?
No, out in Massachusetts. I'm one of them. So, excuse me. Anyways, you know, about a decade later, you know, after my young childhood, just finally starting to get up the nerve to actually start figuring out mushrooms, just because they're everywhere, you know, in the places that I was, you know, especially in, you know, upstate New York and Vermont and things like that. So essentially just sort of burgeoned into something a lot more, and then again, just like Greg, turned into much more of an obsession. And then now owning a business that produces mushrooms essentially, you know, it's taken a whole other turn.
Okay, and I can't wait to hear about your business in just a minute. But Matt, I want to bring you into the conversation. What about you? How did you get into this?
Yeah, I've actually, even from a very young age, been fascinated with mushrooms and would kind of poke around in the woods looking for them. And then in my late teens and early 20s, I worked in restaurants and kind of just got interested in new ingredients. And that ultimately led me into the woods to kind of look for edible mushrooms, and I started as a forager.
Okay, for the two of you who started getting interested in mushrooms as kids, most kids don't like to eat mushrooms. Did you like them? Were you different?
Honestly, I really didn't end up eating very many mushrooms growing up, mostly because my mother hated them, so they really weren't an option in our house. But that quickly branched out once I got into college and started getting into more interesting sort of things with food.
Yeah, and I liked mushrooms. I wasn't exposed to anything except for the few species that you found in the grocery stores. But yeah, that soon blossomed into the array of edible species that are now available to us.
Okay, well, let's start with foraging and ask you, Greg, how good of a place is Maine to be a mushroom forager, and why or why not?
One of the better. Maine has got a rich diversity of forest types. So we have, conifer forests, we've got mixed hardwood, and we have miles and miles and miles of open land that is easy to access. And so it's a wonderful place. And the old farm areas, fields and pastures, just real diversity.
And if someone's a beginner at foraging mushrooms, what do you suggest? If someone's listening to this saying, I've always heard my neighbor so-and-so or my grandfather foraged for mushrooms, but I'm afraid. I'm afraid I'm going to pick the wrong ones. Where does someone even start learning how to explore the woods near their home and enjoy this hobby?
Well, start slowly. And that statement, my grandfather, my uncle, my aunt, I hear that story from people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and they almost invariably say, and I lost that. I lost interest when I was a teenager, and I'd like to get that knowledge back. And so that's where we are. And where you start, get some good field guides or really visit the responsible internet sites, take a class, join the Maine Mycological Association and go on forays. And if you have a neighbor or a friend whose judgment and knowledge you trust, befriend them. Be as nice as you can so they smile when you're coming.
So if someone gets a book and they start to teach themselves, is it pretty clear? I mean, will you know by looking and matching the picture to your book and reading about them? Are there great mushrooms that are very similar to dangerous mushrooms, or are they pretty different? I mean, some bird varieties, I'm thinking about the birding shows we have, are
the
really
Dickey
close,
birds.
And you really have to look closely to know one from another.
Well, the old myth is you can never know mushrooms unless you've got a microscope and years of experience, and there are some groups of mushrooms where that is absolutely the case. But there's others that are relatively easy without toxic lookalikes. We call those the foolproof few. And for the most part, those are the only ones to start with, and most people never go beyond them. So learn the easy ones.
The foolproof few.
Yeah.
I like that. And they are, let me guess, chanterelles?
Usually.
What else?
Chanterelles, black trumpets, the hen of the woods, the maitake that you mentioned earlier. The chicken mushroom, though, that you have to be careful with that because it's toxic raw and some people don't agree with it. Puffballs, many, many people start out eating the clear white puffballs because they're absolutely simple. Oyster mushrooms of the three or four different varieties we have here. Those are some of the easy ones.
Okay. I want to talk about your guys' businesses.
Sure.
When did you start? It's not really that old, is it?
No. North Spore is almost 3.5 years old at this point. And we started as actually solely growing oyster mushrooms and have since kind of branched into mushroom spawn production. And people use spawn much like they use seeds for plant production only to grow mushrooms. So, we're continuing to grow, experiment with new species. It's been a wild ride.
So, Matt, if we walked into your facility, what would it look like?
So you'd walk in. The first thing you would see would be two different walk-in coolers. There's one that we designate for fresh mushrooms and the other we designate for spawn. If you continued down the path, and we're actually in an old textile mill, so it kind of has that aesthetic as well. You'd see our laboratory where we produce mushroom spawn. We actually have a culture bank where we hold on to over 100 different species of mushroom, and we're able to kind of fool around, create spawn for ourselves as well as other mushroom farms or home producers. And then if you kind of went further into the facility, you'd see our fruiting rooms, which are basically indoor greenhouses, except for instead of trying to maximize sunlight, we're maximizing humidity and air control, ventilation, so that the mushrooms that are exhaling CO2 don't suffocate themselves. There's a lot of gas exchange that happens.
Oh, wow. Okay. What about you, Greg? When did your business start? Excuse me. I'm sorry. Mark, when did your business start? And tell us what mushroom substrate is and why it's so important.
Well, that is a very interesting question, especially the mushroom substrate side. Main Cap and Stem started our sort of journey as also something very similar to Norse Spore, fruiting mushrooms, doing it from essentially A to Z. You know, we would produce the substrate and then we would fruit it and we'd harvest it and sell it to chefs, wholesale and retail at farmers markets and things like that. And then essentially that was a 8-day-a-week sort of process. It was never ending. And essentially my partner Eric and I really just wanted to have weekends. We wanted to have a home life of some sort. So what we said to ourselves is what we want to do is we want to buy organic mushroom substrate from a producer, and then we'll just fruit the mushrooms and then we'll harvest them and sell them and life will be wonderful. We'll have our weekends, all of that sort of thing. And we're searching and searching and searching for someone that can actually give us what we need as a business. And there's no one really on the open market that was offering organic substrate to a smaller non-industrial farm.
And when you say substrate, you're talking about the material that the mushrooms grow in.
That is correct. Sorry, I probably should have got into that. So what substrate is just like any growing thing in general, you need carbon and nitrogen. So the carbon comes in the form of red oak sawdust is what we use, which is just an agricultural byproduct from in-state Maine. So then we blend that with the nitrogen, and there are certain species of mushrooms that like different types of nitrogen. Some like, let's say, wheat middlings, which is literally the trash left over after the flour-making process. Some like organic soybean hulls. Oyster mushrooms in particular really enjoy that. So depending on what we're producing for individual farms, because we do special orders for wholesale farms all across the nation, we will use whichever nitrogen that is. So anyways, that's the general gist of the substrate.
So you're really fulfilling a niche market.
Correct.
And as the mushroom industry grows, is your business growing?
Definitely.
Really quickly?
Yeah, I would say so. Probably quicker than we would like. we definitely need to grow or die sort of thing, and we are growing, which is great.
And what about you're not nodding as well, Matt?
Yeah. The spawn business is, we're actually maxed out on capacity for spawn production right now, but expanding our ability to produce spawn and, in a similar place for sure. We're also pretty tight on space in the mill right now. So definitely looking to, in the future, expand onto some land and maybe experiment doing kind of the whole traditional farming structure as well.
Wow, good problems to have. If you have questions about mushrooms, 1-800-399-3566. Our email talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. What are the most popular? What's hot in mushrooms? What are you getting orders for?
Well, right now, actually, it's a bumper year for hen of the woods. I mean, there's hen of the woods everywhere right now. So we're seeing a lot of that come in from foragers and finding it ourselves. But I would say the mainstay of our business is definitely oyster mushrooms and shiitake.
Okay. And I understand, Greg, that you've written a book about this, is that mushrooms can be medicinal. I mean, people are already afraid to pick the wrong ones because they're afraid they might be poisonous. How do we take the step for medicinal uses and know which to use for what purpose?
Again, it's about knowledge. It's about taking your time to learn. I mean, there are some common mushrooms that are quite medicinal. And the great thing is, if you're afraid of going out and collecting them yourself, many of these are mushrooms that are easily cultivated. The book I wrote was focused on those that grow wild here, but the shiitake is a great medicinal mushroom with a good, long history of good research. But of the wild ones that are also easily cultivated, the hen of the woods or maitake is one, the oyster mushrooms, others like the lingzhi or reishi Can be both cultivated, and we have a couple of varieties that grow wild here.
And what are they used for? Are they all used for the same thing, or just do different mushrooms sort of have different medicinal purposes?
Perfect question. Many of them are immune stimulators or modulators. So they work with our body, and our body kind of looks at them like they are foreign particles, and it stimulates an immune response to boost the fighting part of your body. Other ones have really nice anti-inflammatory properties and a few other things. The oyster mushrooms are really good for lipid control, so they're good for high cholesterol or atherosclerotic plaque. So you really have to know your mushroom. Chaga has gotten really popular in this part of the world, and it's a mild immune stimulator and an excellent anti-inflammatory.
So does somebody need to treat these mushrooms in a special way, drink them in a tea or grind them into a powder, or is just throwing oyster mushrooms in a stir fry going to give you the medicinal benefit?
Both and. Some of them, if you want to concentrate the medicinal properties, you have to get fancy. And you make double extraction tinctures or powder them. But just kind of working them into your regular food is kind of that concept of functional food. It's food that we eat for its nutritional benefits, and it's got an added benefit to it. So if you ate oyster mushrooms on a regular basis to help control your challenges with high cholesterol, that would be a good thing. And always consult your medical provider around those decisions.
All right. Well, we do have to take a break. Again, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Jackson Laboratory, nonprofit genetics research in Bar Harbor, discovering precise genomic solutions to disease. JAX.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how a young Winston Churchill earned distinction and tested his mettle in war.
He wanted to be in the most dangerous battles he could find, and he wanted to be noticed. He wanted to stand out.
We speak with Candace Millard about her new book, Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. Join us.
That's Fresh Air tonight at 7 on Maine Public Radio. The public is invited to attend any open meeting of Maine Public's Governing Board and Advisory Committee's meetings. For more information regarding specific dates, times, and locations of Maine Public's open meetings, visit our website, mainepublic.org, or call Audience Services at 1-800-884-1717.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're learning all about mushrooms. With me in the studio, Matt McGinnis, co-founder of North Spore, Mark Robinson, co-owner of Cap and Stem Mushroom Company, and Greg Marley, founder of Mushrooms for Health and author of two books on mushrooms. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with Elspeth, who's calling from Calais. Hi, Elspeth. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. I live, as you know, in Calais, up in northern Maine, and I am an avid outdoors woman, and I have a really small dog who's my trusty sidekick in all of my endeavors. And we had the unfortunate experience of hiking up in Canada where he ate a mushroom that caused him to hallucinate. So I would actually just love to know what types of fungi, mushrooms, perhaps even algae included, to keep an eye out to keep his little mitts off of it so he doesn't have threats to his health and wellness.
Elspeth, before I have my guests answer your question, I want to ask you, how could you tell he was hallucinating? What
was
he
exactly
doing?
I was wondering.
He had crazy neurological symptoms. Unfortunately, our drive home was so long that by the time we got home, he'd fully metabolized the mushroom. But he was balking at our hands. He freaked out at a pair of socks. Retrospectively, it was kind of funny, but at the time, we thought our dog was going to die, so it wasn't so happy at the time. But it really neurological symptoms that were confirmed later by our vet that were pretty typical of, consuming a type of fungi.
Sure. Great questions. Lots of people out there have dogs who will eat anything. Lots of Labrador retrievers in Maine. What's your advice?
Well, usually I think terriers have better taste than that, but probably what your dog ate was called Amanita muscaria, the fly agaric, which is right now really common all across Maine. It's fruiting everywhere, bright, kind of yellowish, sometimes a little orange with white patches scattered across the top, stately, beautiful mushroom. And it contains a couple of compounds which are hallucinogenic and cause agitation and sometimes deep coma-like sleep, and dogs love it. So do reindeer. But that's another story. And yeah, in terms of broad mushrooms, dogs can be attracted to mushrooms that smell strongly. It's hard to – Amanita, the muscaria, that I know they're attracted to. Others, it depends on their personality. You just kind of keep your eye on your dog, and I know that's challenging. And I'll stay away from algae completely myself.
Okay. And Greg, with your help, we'll find a picture after the program, put it on our Facebook page, and so people can see this mushroom to keep your dogs away from. But I want to ask a related question. Elspeth, thanks so much for your call. One of our engineers here at Maine Public, John Bradford, posted a video for us of deer in his backyard eating mushrooms. And he's wondering if animals know the difference, wild animals.
Most definitely. Yeah, in particular, at least this time of year, deer really absolutely love a type of mushroom that we find among pine trees called matsutakes. It's actually kind of funny because the foragers who tend to make quite a bit of money when they go foraging for these, they're in direct competition with the deer.
Oh, well, and here's a question. Nick on Facebook asks, if I see a mushroom in my yard that has been nibbled on by wild animals, is it likely to be edible by people?
It means that maybe that wild animal did so successfully, but they're able to metabolize some toxins that we can't. So no, that's not a good indication at all.
So maybe, but don't go by that.
No, I'm going to say no.
Okay.
Well, not worth it.
Okay. Okay, great. We'll go to Cynthia in Chesterville. Hi, Cynthia. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that I question calling Chanterelle one of the foolproof few, because from what I understand, there are a remarkable number of optimistic, very amateur collectors who mistake the jack-o'-lantern for chanterelles, and the jack-o'-lantern grows on wood. But when you're really excited and you're just thinking you know what you're doing, and you might be even showing off, you'll say, "Oh, there, it's orange, and it's and there's, a
okay, Cynthia,
what I saw last night on my plate."
Thanks for the warning. How does somebody know the difference between a chanterelle, which is lovely, and a jack-o'-lantern, which is not?
The biggest difference is, several things. The jack-o'-lantern mushroom is decidedly orange. It is beautifully orange. The chanterelle is kind of a warm lemon, kind of mustard yellow. And jack-o'-lanterns tend to grow in dense clusters from one point. They're called cespitose clusters. And they often grow on ground from wood rather than on wood. And they also have very knife-edged gills versus chanterelle's roughened gills, but that's a more challenging one. And the best thing to do is, if you have any doubt at all, throw it out. And if it's the first time you've ever eaten a chanterelle, consult someone to make sure that you know what you're doing and you're not making a mistake.
There are also other identifying features of chanterelles. They have a really wonderful fruity apricot-like scent. Just the type of woods and areas that they grow in tend to be slightly different from jack-o'-lanterns. But that's definitely an issue. We actually had a forager bring in jack-o'-lantern mushrooms thinking that they were honey mushrooms, which is another common edible, and we had to identify it and obviously throw it out.
Wow. Cynthia, thanks for your call. A similar question. Barry on Facebook says, a seller said that mushrooms must be cooked to be beneficial and to avoid eating them raw. Is this true?
Typically, yes, that is true. There are some cultural norms in some places around the world where mushrooms are consumed raw, but typically it's usually a best practice to cook them based on the cell wall structure. It's made of something called chitin that our bodies can't process properly. So in order to denature and break that down, the heating process does that. Also, drying does it as well, as does pickling, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm. And there are some really wonderful edible mushrooms that are poisonous unless they're cooked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So definitely important to know that, too.
And how cooked? Is sautéing them in a little butter to put in an omelet cooked enough?
That's always one of those questions. What is cooked? And what I say for a fleshy mushroom, if you put it in that sauté pan and you put a heat with it with maybe a little bit of salt, and it gives off its water. And when that water has boiled away, then you can be sure it's firmly well cooked.
Okay, and everyone else is nodding as you say that. We'll go to Mary in Vassalboro. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just would like to know if this has been an unusual summer for mushrooms, because everywhere I go, I find mushrooms in my yard, up and down the road, in the woods. They're just more mushrooms than I can ever remember. And I mean, I mow my lawn all the time, but they keep on coming back. Is this a weather thing, or is this a normal year or an abnormal year?
Mary, I've noticed the same thing. Is this a particularly good year?
It's been a frustrating year. It was a wonderful late spring, early summer, just phenomenal.
Oh, sure. Best you liked that Morels. Rainy June, didn't you?
Yes, I did. You betcha. And then we had this, what were my friends and I have been calling a flash drought. So it was very hot, very dry for about 8 weeks. And then we had a couple of good deep rains, and that's what brought out everything over the past 2 to 3 weeks. One of the biggest flushes, which is a fruiting of the Boletus edulis, the porcini that I've seen in probably 8 years, and some other things really in abundance. And some of the, it's all absolutely weather-related.
That is interesting. And it is interesting how quickly, after a deep rain, we'll see them.
About 10 days for maximum benefit, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for your question, Mary. Good one. We have an email from Gudrun. Herundo Wildlife Refuge is located in Old Town. It spans 2,400 acres of land. It focuses on environmental education. I'm editing as I read here. We will be holding our annual program, Mushroom Identification and Walk, Saturday, October 7th from 10 to 2. So we'll post that on our Facebook page as well, but great resource for somebody in the Old Town area. John on Facebook, I'm curious how animals know which varieties of mushrooms are safe to consume. How do they know?
I would have to assume that it's just passed down through genetics. They know because they know what, you know, they know their environment, you know, inherently. You know, it's something that they've – it's just part of them. You know, unlike humans where we move around very much, they tend to stay within the same circles. So they know their area very well. They know their individual species, usually just by smell.
Ray asks, I'm curious, if you find a certain type of wild mushroom in an area, does it return there each year, and can you find it there later?
It depends. So some mushrooms grow symbiotically with the trees in that area. And so long as the forest is not disturbed, they should come back in that region, though not necessarily every year. And others, like the shaggy mane, a wonderful edible, will grow in abundance in an area for a few years using a resource that it rots, and then you won't see them there again. So it really varies.
We'll go to Nemo calling from Stu Ben. Hi, Nemo. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Get ready to be amazed. I'm reading from the January, February, March issue of Orchid Digest, page 28. In the Mare National Forest in eastern Oregon, it was reported that a fungus, Amarilia, honey mushroom extended over 2,200 acres with a mass of 650 tons, thought to be the largest organism in terms of area in the world.
Oh, my. Yeah. Is a honey mushroom edible?
It is, yeah.
If you cook it.
I was going to say, that would take a very large pan.
Hey, you thought a blue whale was big.
Yeah.
That
the
is
three
something.
Of us are actually joking before the show, talking about this honey mushroom in Oregon, and that someone's got to call in about the honey mushroom in Oregon. And sure enough,
well, people like things that are very, very, very large, especially a mushroom. Nemo, thanks for sharing. We'll go to Dave in Portland. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
I wonder if your speakers might talk a little bit about using mushrooms for composting and landscaping. I understand that there is a type of mushroom that will actually break down disposable diapers.
They're pointing at you, Matt.
Oh, they're pointing at me. Well, I know that there is some research being done on a particular species of mushroom that can degrade plastics. I'm not recalling the scientific name of it. Maybe Greg could help me. But as far as composted material, mushrooms make a great amendment to compost. We produce a ton of this kind of mushroom substrate byproduct and actually give much of it to local farms, and they find great value with it. So
interesting. So if you have mushrooms growing on your lawn and you're not comfortable with eating them, pull them up and throw them in your compost bin?
Sure.
Certainly not going to hurt anything.
Yeah.
Wow.
And,
all right.
You know, when you put down a layer of wood chips as a landscape element, invariably some kind of fungus is going to start eating them mm-hmm. and produce mushrooms. And some of those mushrooms might be edible, like the wine cap stropharia. Some of them will be poisonous. Some of them will be really foul and stinky, like the stinkhorns. Yeah.
Dave, thanks so much for your call. An email here from, I believe it's pronounced Gort. I have been eating mushrooms on a daily basis for over a year now, and I'm interested in learning how to identify the ones growing on my property, especially the ones that are on the lawn growing out of dead oak and maple trees. I went online and I couldn't find anything that looks like what I have in abundance. Could you recommend a specific book that would be able to help me?
You know, there was a book that was published about 4 years ago that is specific to the mushrooms that fruit in association with oak trees. If you Google mushrooms growing with oaks, you'll come up with it. I'm blanking on the author's name. That would be a really good one to start with. But in terms of eating them, go slow. You know, take your time to make sure you know, because there are so many different species that fruit under oak trees.
All right. John writes in an email, I have chicken fat or slippery jack mushrooms all over my yard, mm-hmm. wondering how you would prepare those to eat.
You know, they're not the most popular, but I would get them when they're young and firm, and then I would saute them with a little bit of salt. If you like sriracha, add that to it, and then either butter or olive oil, and then finish them hard. In other words, turn the heat up so that they brown on the edges and get just a touch crispy. That'll be the best flavor and consistency.
I've heard that some of the dried porcini products on the market are actually slippery jack.
Yeah.
We'll go to Reiner calling from Orono. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I grew up in Germany, and I'm an avid forager in the Orono area and Old Town area. When you go to school and you have biology classes, your biology teacher takes the class on trips into the woods to identify mushrooms. They are subsequently brought back to the classroom in various states of development. They are then examined under the microscope. The children are getting a permission slip from their parents. The mushrooms are then prepared in school, and the class will eat them. That's great education, not only in the face of mushrooms, but overall, as far as I'm concerned. I wonder whether this could be an idea to be transplanted into biology mm-hmm. teachers.
Be difficult.
Yeah, it would be lovely. You'd need to make sure that the biology teachers know what they are doing. And again, you know, we are in America, which is still, you know, we have that basis of mycophobia. We fear mushrooms. So you have to overcome that to get comfortable.
Reiner, thanks for your call. Mycophobia, another new word for the day. We're going to go, to an email from Facebook post. Are there some classes you can recommend for someone who wants to get started in foraging for mushrooms?
Yeah, North Spores tries to do some mushroom forays in the fall. We actually just did a couple at Pineland Farms a couple weeks ago. We don't have anything scheduled for next month, but that might change in the future. But I know the Maine Mycological Association does forays as well, which is a great resource for Mainers.
Yeah, so the Maine Mycological, generally about 7 or 8 times during the growing season, schedules forays for its members, and membership costs all of about $12. And we meet in various places in the state, and we'll collect mushrooms through a couple of hours and then identify them. I also do foraging and identification workshops. I've got one scheduled for October 7th at Merry Spring Nature Park in Camden, Maine. A class is an excellent way of learning it. And hanging out with mushroomers, like with the Maine Mycological Association, is a wonderful way of learning.
All right. Well, we do have to go to another break, but first, a look ahead at tomorrow's program. It's a time to look back at the news of the month, from Susan Collins in healthcare to the latest on Katahdin Woods and Water. So send your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Criterion Theater in Bar Harbor, presenting Mountain Film on tour Saturday, September 30th at 7. Tickets at CriterionTheater.org. And Rooster Brother, the store for cooks and those who love them, at the Union River Bridge in downtown Ellsworth. Many businesses and organizations in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on Maine Public Radio. You hear their mentions every day. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting Maine Public Radio and Classical, Maine Public Television, or MainePublic.org, please visit our website, MainePublic.org. Click on About and then Business Support. Or you can call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. And of course, thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine. Join us at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling for Commonwealth Club of California. Today, attorney Floyd Abrams, author of The Soul of the First Amendment. Abrams is an expert in constitutional law as it relates to the First Amendment and has worked on several notable issues, including the Pentagon Papers and Citizens United. Again, that's the Commonwealth Club of California, today at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program All About Mycology. Joining me in the studio, Mark Robinson, co-owner of Cap and Stem Mushroom Company, Greg Marley with the Maine Mycological Association, and Matt McGinnis, co-founder of North Spore. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. You know, we've been talking a lot about foraging here, but people can cultivate their own mushrooms, right?
Yeah, certainly true. Yeah, in a number of different ways. Some people can grow them on logs in their backyard if they want to just do it in a very low intense sort of way. And that would be something that Matt could probably speak to more than I can.
Great use of shadier parts of your garden. I can't emphasize that enough. Maybe you have a backyard you've always dreamed of growing tomatoes in but never could, you can always do some shiitake logs and fruit those instead.
So if you want to do a shiitake log, is there a type of, do you just take a log from your log pile?
You need to find freshly cut hardwood logs. That's kind of the key. And then purchase mushroom spawn, which is the genetic material to grow mushrooms. And you basically inject the spawn into the logs.
And is there best time of year to do that?
You can do it spring is kind of the traditional time to do it, but you can do it right now as well. This is kind of a window of opportunity. If you held off a few more weeks, you'd probably have to bring the logs indoors at least partially for part of the winter to incubate.
Oh, that sounds like fun. And you sell at Cap and Stem kits that people can maybe give as a gift.
Correct.
or buy for themselves.
Yeah, around the holidays, we usually get a big bump in sales just through our website. It's not the basis behind our business because we're essentially 100% wholesale direct to farms all over the nation. But we also welcome locals to come by and swing by the farm. It's a very, very informal sort of thing. Don't have a retail spot, but I will talk to you, and I'll sell you a kit, no problem, that sort of thing. And we offer 10 different species is pretty typical for what we have around on a normal basis. So people really get their, the pick of the litter for what they want to do growing wise.
So, Matt, if somebody wants to do what you've described with a freshly cut hardwood log, and would they order spawn from you or from someone else?
We actually produce mushroom kits as well. They're a different stage of growth than the cap and stem kits. There's kind of the indoor style kits. Where you can fruit mushrooms on your kitchen counter, but there's also outdoor log kits, which have basically a pack of what we call plug spawn that you put into the logs. But yeah, that's all available, and we love turning people on to growing mushrooms outside.
Well, it does sound like a lot of fun, and a lot of people have shade in their yard in Maine. We'll go to Claire calling from Franklin. Hi, Claire. Go ahead.
Hi. I just had a couple of things. Maybe somebody is inventing a tag or a you know, some like you have for testing lead poisoning or some a swipe that you so you could identify the mushrooms more easily and know whether you're eating something safe. I'm waiting for somebody to invent that. I once brought some into Cooperative Extension, and they said, yeah, but we are not going to guarantee what they are, even if we had a great microscope, which everybody asks us, why don't we have one, that, you know, nobody wants to be responsible for saying, yes, that's okay. And it just seems like we're ready technologically to have such an easy ID thing. So maybe you guys can work on that. And in the meantime, I want to talk about the fact that so many people forage on my land in Franklin County that in the beginning I thought it was lovely. And you know, I learned a little bit myself. But when I found that there was a couple of people that had been doing it for many years, not that you want to put people out of work, and they were taking like 40 or 50 pounds of mushrooms several times a week, and then meeting with a mushroom, if there is such a thing, a mushroom purveyor. It's not a bad thing necessarily, except for nobody ever even asks me, or they don't send me $5 toward my taxes, which are, you know, incredibly high, I think. And so that's an issue about, like, can you just forage? Should this just go on? People forage for their living on somebody else's property?
Well, it seems to me that's unethical. Would you say, Greg? I mean, you need permission, right? No,
not in the state of Maine. Now, if you have your land posted, that is a very different story. If your land is posted, then people do have to ask you specifically for permission to enter your land.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to disagree with you.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
People can enter your land without permission if it's not posted, but it doesn't mean that they can collect the four mushrooms off it. That's because those go with the land. It's not wildlife. And I think, you know, what I urge people to do is practice good ethics. Find out whose property you're on and go knock on the door and ask. And I almost never have had somebody say, no, I don't want you to do that. And when they have, it says, you know, yes, because my neighbor down the street collects those mushrooms. So it's a great way to meet people and to be friendly and to know that you're not disappointing somebody.
And to educate them on what's growing on their land. I think a lot of people would probably be happy to know that they have an esteemed edible mushroom growing, you know, on their front steps. You know,
right. And what about, is it possible that mushrooms can be over-harvested? Do people need to know, you know, what is the proper amount to take to allow that, I don't even know what you'd say, that plot that...
Well, the mushroom is a fruiting body that's coming from underground or in the log, and collecting that fruiting body, just like if you pick every apple on your tree, you're not going to affect how many apples come the next year. So it's difficult to easily over-harvest.
So and don't pull it up from the roots.
Be gentle in terms of the forest floor. Chaga, I think, can be over-harvested. It's being depleted, but most things not. The other thing I would say is, particularly for those people who are commercially harvesting, commercially foraging, they have a larger responsibility in terms of ethical practices. You know, someone who's gathering a basket of edibles for their own table is not going to have a large impact.
All right. Well, with Claire, what would you recommend she do? Should she call the police or should she approach people individually? I mean, you know, I'm sure she's not the only one who's got people on her property harvesting mushrooms.
Yeah, Claire, I would say anytime you find someone who's been collecting your property, you say, you know, if you haven't asked my permission, you're trespassing. Would you like me to post my property or would you like to talk to me? And bring me some mushrooms. And if you sell 40 pounds a week, you know, where's my cut? I mean, let's be honest about that, because it would be sad if she needed to post her property, but it's the responsibility of all of us foragers to be ethical.
All right, Claire, good question. Thank you. Marsha on Facebook asks, have you mentioned a resource people can use if they've ingested a poisonous mushroom? And I'm going to add to that, how do you know? What are the symptoms if you've eaten something? How do you know it was the mushroom?
Your question is a good one, Jennifer. Officially now there are about 15 different international classes of mushroom toxins. The most common one we call the GI irritants, and you're going to note because you're starting to feel nauseous and you're going to be worshiping at the porcelain bowl. But others, yeah, it's complex. It's not an easy answer. If you're concerned, if you've eaten a mushroom and you're starting to get ill, call the Northern New England Poison Center at 1-800-222-1222. And they will typically ask for you to try and get a photograph of the mushroom. They'll send it to me or another mycologist for identification. And from the mushroom, we can tell you what the toxin group is, and we'll know what to do, whether you need to seek medical attention or not.
How much time do you have?
Some toxins, like muscarine, within about 20 minutes. Usually it's an hour to 2 hours with most of them. And the worst case scenario, the ones that can destroy your liver or your kidneys, you're usually 8 to 10 hours before the beginning of symptoms.
So once you feel badly, do not wait to see. Don't say, I'm going to go to bed tonight and see how I feel in the morning.
That's a good idea. No, it's not. And particularly if you're anywhere unsure of what species you ate. If you know you ate a bolete and it's only going to cause gastrointestinal and you want to write it out, even then it's good to consult with somebody to be sure. And calling the Northern New England Poison Center, there's no charge for that, and their staff are really, really professional.
All right. We're going to move on to Margaret, who's calling from Orland. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Good. Well, I remember back in 1954 when I first came to Maine, and that was because I came up here as a young bride, 22, and spent my honeymoon on an island off of Rockland, and it was during Hurricane Edna. That was interesting, and the island was covered with spruce trees and moss. It was enchanted, and I fell in love with mushrooms. So my husband bought me a mushroom book, and since then I've been a devoted forager. But there were tons, and we came up many, many summers to the same island, and I discovered that there were many, many chanterelles growing abundantly along the edges of the forest there, as you know, next to the ocean. And I discovered that the reason they were growing there was because the spruce trees condensed the fog and dripped it down. Well, I tried to interest friends, acquaintances with the mushrooms, and the Maine people just thought it was like eating garbage or something. and for years and years, nobody was interested. So I'm enchanted with this sudden love affair with mushrooms up here in Maine.
Well, Margaret, thanks for calling. And I think that's the case with everything. I mean, we are getting more adventurous. And I remember talking to a goat farmer and talking about when she was going to farmers markets and trying to get people to try goat cheese, and they wouldn't. And boy, has that changed.
Yeah, definitely. We love throwing new species of edible mushrooms on our farmers market tables and kind of getting their response and seeing how people utilize them and cook them. And we also are lucky to work with an amazing group of chefs around Portland and up the coast, as far north as MDI, actually. So they always give us some great ideas for how to cook them, too.
Margaret, thanks for your call. I'm going to try to, squeeze in one more call. We'll go to Steve in Camden. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. Very interesting topic. Thank you. I had heard somewhere that there was a type of mushroom or fungus that can be grown into forms or patterns to make things like egg cartons and even six-pack rings. Do you know anything about this, and what's the state of that technology? Seems like it's a good idea.
Yeah, there's a really cool company, I think based in upstate New York, and I'm spacing on the name. But one of the stages of the life cycle of the mushroom is the mycelium, which is kind of this web-like structure that consumes the mushroom's food. And you can actually form that. If you make a mold, you can have the mycelium grow into the mold and make these amazing packaging materials. So it's definitely this kind of
frontier. So the
sky's frontier
the limit.
Great.
Yeah. That's great. You guys, did you find something quickly on the web?
There's actually something else that's very interesting as well. It's actually a new type of vegan leather that a company is making. It's called Muskin, M-U-S-K-I-N. Very interesting stuff, and it's not really well utilized in the fashion industry yet. But from what I understand, it's gaining popularity because they're able to make it into whatever designs or colors that they would like, as opposed to more traditional leather.
That's so cool. And it's going to be our last word. Thank you all for being here. That was Mark Robinson, co-owner of Cap and Stem Mushroom Company of Maine. Also here, Greg Marley with the Maine Mycological Association, the author of two books on mushrooms, and Matt McGinnis, one of the founders of North Spore, which cultivates edible mushrooms. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.